why tragedy anyway? Isn't there enough misery and suffering in the world without subjecting ourselves to a focused, concentrated version of tragedy? And I'd like to suggest perhaps a few reasons why drama in general and why tragedy does address us, and maybe in the end in such a way that it is not finally a depressing but somehow still an exhilarating experience. I think one of the things that strikes me about tragedy is that it is meant to give us a certain kind of an experience. It isn't primarily designed to instruct us, to teach us a lesson, and it isn't, I don't think, designed principally to entertain us in the sense that comedy entertains us. We sit back and we laugh, whether it's Wes Preeb doing the Florence Nightingale act, or the trio of Baldies who were singing last night. We get a kick out of that because we're leaning back and enjoying the scene. Drama does something else, tragic drama. It somehow draws us in, and it gives us a kind of a vicarious experience. If we enjoy it or if we learn something from it, that I think is a kind of byproduct. Tragedy does more, though, than give us vicarious experience. I think it draws us into something that all of us intuit we cannot escape in some way or another. And I'd like to reduce it to three items. One is it confronts us with our own finitude, finally, with our death. Because almost always tragedy shows us a person who's suddenly aware that he's on life's escalator and he's going somewhere and there's no more getting out. It isn't like taking another year off for college because I'm not quite ready to get into life. No, now this is it. He's on the escalator and we know where it's going, and we sense that's our story too. Second thing is the theme of misery and suffering. Now, all of us have experienced a kind of inarticulate misery and suffering in some way or another, I think. But what happens in tragedy is that the suffering takes on voice. Sometimes it even takes on song. And it also takes on question, like why suffering and why me? And how does it look like when a person is undergoing that? And what happens when others are involved in it with him? And a third factor is the problem of evil and of guilt. Suffering that is just victimization is pathetic. It tears us up in here, but we do not get as involved as we do when we sense that a person has somehow brought this thing on himself. And that raises the question, I think, of guilt. And amidst all of this, the whole problem of evil hovers through the experience of tragedy. Well, philosophers philosophize about all of this, and again, we sit back and we make interesting observations and statements. Tragedy foregoes the pleasure of philosophizing, and it throws us right into the experience itself. So I think these are several things that strike me as being crucial to why tragedy is an important thing for us to reflect about, no matter who we are, whether we're interested in literature or theology, or whether we're interested in medicine or in law. Because everyone deals with these same kinds of problems, also, I think, in something like a law practice. Or if one is working as a nurse, or whatever. I think perhaps one comprehensive thing that it's worth saying is that a dramatist does not simply present human experience, but he subtly gives it interpretation. And as we're listening to or talking about a play, as we will be today, we kind of lean back and we wonder, well, where is Shakespeare coming through? We're into a Shakespeare play today. I wonder what he really thinks about this. And I will pick out a few passages which people have felt, here Shakespeare's tipping his hand in King Lear. And we maybe have some time to talk about that toward the end. Now, just a word about Shakespearean drama. I will not give a long introduction. I want to get into the play as soon as possible. But I would like to say a little bit about some of the mix that comes into Shakespearean drama to give us a sense of what he does with it, how he goes way beyond it. He's an inheritor of a whole medieval tradition of stories, which were viewed as tragedies, which dealt with the rise and falls of kings. There was a book called A Mirror of Magistrates. And the whole point of telling the stories, what they called tragic stories of the rise and falls of kings, was to be salutary lesson for magistrates, hence the mirror for magistrates. And generally there were two interpretations. One was, it's chance, fortuna. It's like a great wheel. Up you go, and you're at the king of the royal mountain, as we used to play as kids. And then eventually, you know, someone's going to dethrone you. And down you go, and that's fortune and misfortune. Another theory was that when the magistrate falls down, that is justice. The law of the universe is that the man who misuses power is finally going to get his comeuppance. So there's the theme of retributive justice. There's a third interesting theme that gradually comes into Elizabethan theater, and that's the Roman theme. It comes from a dramatist called Seneca, who was delighted in horror, in littering the stage with corpses, in grotesqueries. And the Senecan play was also interested in passion, seeing a man overcome with passion and seeing what happens when passion just unwinds. Shakespeare inherits all of this, but he also inherits something else. And that is what I think is quite widely now spoken of as, in one word, the Elizabethan world picture. And that is a world of great order, finally. A series of concentric orders. There's the order inside the man. That's like a little microcosm. And if his reason is in charge of his appetites and his passions, that man's house is in order. His family life is a slightly larger circle. And then there's finally the state. And ultimately, there's the whole cosmos. Sometimes there's an insurrection inside a person's being. And Shakespeare likes to use an analogy that the insurrection inside a person's being is like a mutiny in a state. And then he loves to reinforce his sense that there is trouble abroad by developing a storm. So that, for instance, in King Lear, one of the great scenes is the scene of the storm on the heath. And the storm outside, needless to say, is but a pale representation of the storm that's going on inside Lear's breast. This whole sense of an Elizabethan order has strong Christian roots, though basically the Shakespearean stage is highly secularized. That is to say, he doesn't feel any obligation to preach Christian doctrine. So he's tremendously free to work with all of these materials. And what is so magnificent, I think, is the kind of massive experience that he's able to achieve. It's like a great symphony in Lear. Now, one last thing, a little bit by way of introduction about the play itself, its plot. The play, King Lear, basically is a story of a king who in old age decides to retire and divests himself of his responsibilities and of his power by giving his power and so on to his daughters. And that goes back to an old story in history and a later dramatization of it. And what mistake the king makes is that he disowns his one loyal daughter and gives over his goods to his two unscrupulous daughters. And now, in the ancient story, everything is finally set right because the good daughter comes back and rescues the king, and the king is restored. Now, Shakespeare doesn't let it come out that happily. Shakespeare picks up another story. It's a story of taken from Spenser's Arcadia, no, Sir Philip Sidney's Arcadia, in which a father trusts an untrustworthy son and disowns the son who's loyal and faithful to him. Shakespeare takes that as a kind of subplot, and it reinforces the main plot. And now what's interesting is what Shakespeare does with the story. He complicates it. He darkens it. He darkens it so much that a number of modern interpreters take King Lear as the great anticipation of the modern angst and agony which is expressed in nihilism, that finally life has no values at all, and nothing but chaos really is at stake. That's how strong the play impacts people today. So that's briefly a word about the plot. If you want to summarize it in one word, people who are looking for patterns think of Lear as Shakespeare's Purgatorio. It's the great purgatory. Macbeth, they take to be his Inferno. And Antony and Cleopatra, a kind of parallel to his Paradiso. At any rate, in Lear, we're in purgatory. We're in agonized suffering. Maybe one or two other things. His language, Shakespeare's language, is magnificent here. And one of the things that I think makes Lear so great is that Shakespeare permits Lear the privilege of going mad on stage. And he is absolutely eloquent in his madness. And the character parallel to him, Gloucester, whose son betrays him, he also suffers greatly. But he is not accorded the privilege of madness. He stays sane, and he has grief and pain, and he is prosaic. King Lear goes crazy. But there is a kind of reason in his madness, and it's deeply moving, I think. Finally, there are a lot of interesting characters in the play, and even those that are most despicable, with maybe one or two exceptions, Shakespeare somehow still treats as a human being. He deeply respects each individual. And some of them are touching, like the fool, for example, who is anything but just someone who clowns around and entertains the king, but is a person whose wit and wisdom is so sensitive and so sharp. He's the one person who can reach through to the king as he's isolated himself from everyone else. And that fool is so sensitive to the suffering that he's taking it into himself. And many people have speculated what happens to the fool in the course of the play, because he just vanishes. One of the theories is that the fool dies of grief. He simply can't take it, what happened. Well, I think we're just about ready to look into the play. One person I heard lecture about this said, there's always a great debate whether Hamlet or Lear is the greatest of the Shakespearean tragedies. And for a long time, I think Hamlet stood in top place for lots of different reasons, partly because of the magnificent poetry and whatever. But somehow, Lear seems to be the play of the 20th century. It strikes a number of themes that really come home to us. One of them is the theme of meaning or meaninglessness. And there's a terrifying sense that the world is just falling apart. Another great underlying theme is the theme and by the way, the theme of meaning or meaninglessness, I think, relates to the theme of sanity and insanity. But that's the second theme, the theme of personal sanity and insanity. I think our age is very concerned with that. We have mental hospitals. And we're concerned about our neuroses and our psychoses. We heard some of that in one of the lectures this morning. A third interesting emphasis is the theme on sexual perversion. At one point, when Lear is most lucidly mad, he calls the whole world a kind of a bawdy house. Everything is sexually perverted. And then finally, there's that perennial problem of old age. What do you do when you get old? And how do the youngsters treat their parents who are aged? Well, with some of these introductory matters underway now, what I'd like to do is walk through the story in a little more detail and read some of the passages which I think capture some of the moments of poetry and focalize some of the experience of the play. It's an enormous play, and we're going to maybe get scattered bits and pieces of the play, but I hope a sense of it develops as we move along. Shakespeare likes to work with certain images, and sometimes he puts them right on stage. And one of the opening images is a map. The king is there parceling out England. Now, for any loyal Englishman in Shakespeare's time, that must have evoked a feeling of terrible unease, the thought that the British Empire, or the British Commonwealth, would be carved up into pieces. The king, what he is doing, he wants to abdicate from his throne and wants to enjoy his retirement. But that kind of privilege seems not to be accorded to the king. You can't just go into retirement. So far, so good, although that's a bit dangerous. The next sign of danger is that the king asks his daughters to tell them which of them loves him most. And that's the first sign, I think, that we get that the king is not quite in touch with reality. What happens when you ask people, how much do you love me? And two of the daughters play this little game and just tell the king how much they love him. Cordelia, who is his faithful daughter, says to the king, when the king says, speak, she says, nothing, my lord. He says, what can you say? Nothing, my lord. Lear, nothing. Cordelia, nothing. Lear, nothing can come of nothing. Speak again. And then she gives a little speech and she says, you know, father, your daughters, they surely love their husbands as much as they love you. And in a sense, they get some of, their husbands get as much of their love as you do. And if I marry, you will not get all of my love. The king is enraged at this kind of honesty from his daughter. And so within the first few moments of the play, he is already disowning her in a terrifying oath. He gets eloquent the moment he gets emotional. He says to her, so let it be. Thy truth then be thy dower. She says she's going to be true. For by the sacred radiance of the sun, the mysteries of Hecate and the night, by all the operations of the orbs from whom we do exist and cease to be, here I disclaim all my paternal care, propinquity, and property of blood, and as a stranger to my heart and me, hold thee from this forever. A terrifying word. because he's cutting himself off from the one person who speaks truthfully to him. Another loyal person interposes. His name is Kent. And he tries to stop the king. The king says, "Get away. The bow is bent and drawn. Make from the shaft." And Kent answers, "I'd rather die than not interpose. Be Kent unmannerly when Lear is mad. What wouldst thou do, old man?" And then he says he's bound to plainness. Well, the king is not to be stopped, disowns his daughter, and then we see a kind of character test between the two men who are there to bid for the hand of Cordelia. One is Burgundy and the other is France. And Burgundy sort of changes his mind when there's going to be no dowry. And France responds in turn that when he learns what is at stake, that she herself will be the greatest dowry. And then he makes an interesting remark, which I'd like to read now. "Fairest Cordelia, thou art most rich, being poor, most choice, forsaken, and most loved, despised." Interesting lines. One thing I forgot to say at the beginning, Shakespeare does a very interesting thing in this play. He sets it in the pagan time. King Lear came from a time before the Romans conquered England. And so it's a world of pagan gods. And that gives him maximum freedom to explore the whole mystery of the universe and the problems of the cosmos and the individual human being. And yet, do you hear a biblical echo in those lines? "As sorrowful, yet always rejoicing, as poor, yet making many rich, as having nothing, and yet possessing everything." Isn't that interesting? So Cordelia departs. The king has furthermore banned Kent, who dared to oppose him. And the king says, "I will now make the following retirement arrangement. I will spend a month with one daughter, with my 100 knights, and a month with the other daughter." The two daughters consult with one another and say, "Oh, this is going to be a bad thing. Look at how he is with his best daughter, and look what he does with Kent, with his most loyal friend." And they comment, "'Tis the infirmity of his age, yet he hath ever but slenderly known himself." So with these opening lines, it's like a little stone is dislodged from the top of a mountain of snow. And it's like the beginnings of an avalanche that for which there will be no stopping. One critic, Mark Van Doren, has said, "Most plays you can think of as a beginning and a middle and an end." He says this play is all end. I'm going to skip the subplot. There are moments when I'll dip into it. If you're interested in the play, you'll find it fascinating. Edmund, who is the bastard son of Gloucester, plots to gain his father's favor and is very successful in doing so. And then his brother Edgar has to flee for his life. We'll pick that up on occasion. What I want to do is move through the story as quickly as I can to read some of the powerful passages as we move into the play. One of the first things that happens when Lear and his knights are with the first daughter, Goneril, what a name, Goneril. And that was her name in the original story, too. That's not one Shakespeare made up. Goneril is already complaining about the fact that the knights are causing nothing but havoc in her home. And she can't stand that, is going to look for an excuse to cut down the number of knights. And at this point, Kent returns, though he's been banished, and he disguises himself. And this is the first of several important disguises. He is one person who then will commit himself to the king and serve him loyally, even though the king is mad. And he always thinks of the king in terms of his best. The king asks him, "Why on earth would you want to follow me?" Kent says a beautiful thing. The king says, "Do you know me?" Kent says, "No, sir. But you have that in your countenance which I would fain call master." "What's that?" "Kent, authority." Isn't that nice? He reminds the king of what he is, really. And that's very important, because the king's going to fall apart because other people are not confronting him with who he is. So the question who he is one of the agonizing questions for him. The other person who's his friend is the fool. And the fool is a very touching figure. One of the knights says to the king, "Since my young lady, Cordelia, has gone to France, sir, the fool has much pined away." Lear says, "No more of that. No more of that. I have noted it well." It's too painful a thing for him to consider. He suppresses that as many other things. The fool makes all sorts of little remarks, however, which attempt to get through to the king what a mistake he's had. Give you an example. He takes off his fool's hat. It's called a cock's comb. And he says to Kent, "Sirrah, you were best take my coxcomb." Kent says, "Why, fool?" "Fool, why? For taking one's part, that's out of favor," namely the king's. "Nay, if thou canst not smile as the wind sits, thou'lt catch cold shortly. There, take my coxcomb." "Why, this fellow's banished two of his daughters, and did the third a blessing against his will." Now notice how the fool turns everything upside down, right? He's banished two of his daughters. Indeed, in a sense, he has banished them. Before, they were in a way under his control, as long as he controlled the purse and the power. But now they are banished and totally out of control. And the third, a blessing against his will. "If you want to follow him, thou must needs wear my coxcomb." Only a fool would follow a man like that. Goneril enters, talks to Lear, and Lear, up to this point, has suppressed the fact that his daughter was giving him the cold shoulder. Someone has said to him, "You've noticed that you have not been properly treated," and he says, I've tried not to notice that, but I'm beginning to notice it. Goneril comes in. Lear says, "Are you our daughter?" Goneril, "You would make use of your good wisdom and put away these dispositions which of late transport you from what you rightly are." Lear, "Dost any here know me? This is not Lear. Does Lear walk thus, speak thus? Where are his eyes?" "Ha, waking," he says, "'tis not so. Who is it that can tell me who I am?" Lear, when his daughter is treating him the way he's treating, is beginning to flirt with madness. He says, I'm not Lear if you are not treating me like I ought to be treated." He's expecting a certain treatment from her. Well, Goneril already suggests you should disquantify your train. You should cut down the numbers of your knights. And Lear, of course, is enraged by this. "Darkness and devils," he says. "Saddle my horses, call my train together, degenerate bastard. I'll not trouble thee, yet I have another daughter." See how he completely expresses his rage in language that is going to be nothing but provocative. Albany enters, and he complains to Albany, and he tends to do this. One person hurts him, and then he'll complain to someone else. That's one of his great weaknesses, that he looks to others for help, and often to the wrong person. And here's what bothers him: ingratitude. Ingratitude, thou marble-hearted fiend, more hideous when thou show'st thee in a child than the sea monster. And Albany tries to calm him down, and Lear just goes on in more of a rage. And it's interesting, in the midst of this rage against his daughter, suddenly another thought goes into his mind. Oh, most small fault, how ugly didst thou in Cordelia show. And then he beats his head, and he says, oh, Lear, 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 beat at this gate that let thy folly in and thy dear judgment out. An interesting moment. Suddenly, a moment of self-recognition, a sense that he made a bad mistake, and it may be an irrevocable mistake. And yet, as the play develops, we'll see there's more and more that he hasn't learned, and it's going to be much too late for him to learn, because that avalanche is picking up. In the meantime, the daughter has already decided Lear can only have 50 knights. She dismisses 50 of the knights. And Lear comes in and is upset about that, needless to say. And then he departs, and there's some interchange between the husband, Albany, who is unhappy with the kind of disregard which his wife Goneril has for the king. And then we see Lear in an interesting little moment, which I'd like briefly to summarize. He is all alone in front of the palace of Albany, and he's talking with a fool. He's waiting to go to the other daughter, and the fool is trying to talk sense to him and is making some little remarks that it's probably not going to be much better with the other daughter. And Lear half listens to the fool, but in the middle of the conversation, Lear pops out with this remark, I did her wrong. I did her wrong. And the fool goes on, canst thou tell how an oyster makes his shell? No, fool, neither I. But I can tell why a snail has a house. Lear, why? Why to put his head in, and not to give it away to his daughters and leave his horns without a case. Lear, I will forget my nature. So kind a father. Be my horses ready? He doesn't answer. He doesn't answer the fool's words. But the words are getting in. And this conversation goes on. The fool tries to make some more talk, almost like he's trying to catch Lear's, mind so it doesn't stray away. And Lear says, fool says, yes, indeed, about another remark, thou wouldst make a good fool, Lear, to take it again perforce, namely his train. Monster ingratitude. And then finally, and here his last line explodes, the fool says, why, thou shouldst have been old till thou hadst been wise. And Lear, oh, let me not be mad, not mad, sweet heavens. Keep me in temper, I would not be mad. And already he's right on the verge of snapping. Now, I think one of the things about this play, I don't know if have any of you seen Lear? Oh, well, I have never seen it. I'm waiting to see it. I think one of the great tasks of an actor must be, and of a director, is to modulate the play so that these moments of rising passion lead up to the great moments, don't anticipate them, and yet build their way to them. Part of the pain, part of the greatness, is how Shakespeare orchestrates this whole movement, this trip towards insanity. Maybe we should pause here a second. Comment, Rich?
Is that the advantage of that plot, that subplot, which is kind of like a relief? At least when I saw we saw Lear at, where is it, Oregon?
Ashland.
You saw it at Ashland?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it would seem like if you just took the madness and compressed that, that I don't know whether you could tolerate it. And so when everything was seemed to be going to an incredible intensity, mm-hmm. this subplot kind of interjected, and everybody just sort of, you know, took a deep breath to wait for Lear to get back on the stage, because they knew they'd have to hold their breath while he was on. And I don't know whether that's part of the orchestration or not, but it seemed like it was a useful, mm-hmm. almost like a recess from the intensity.
I really like that. I think music is like that too, isn't it? That it builds tension and then releases tension. I don't want to push the musical analogy too far, but yes.
Yeah.
And I appreciate the input of your experience of the play. That it's almost intolerable, isn't it? These scenes with Lear.
Perhaps
Steve?
Another thing that might be this, that Lear is used in language, and that he is so eloquent in the earlier stages of the play when he doesn't know himself. That language is his assumption of the authority of kingship, which he's abdicated, and that his use of language is his, I think, in part an attempt to maintain that authority, yet he has given away his power. He doesn't know himself, so that eloquence doesn't have anything to back, and it doesn't have the true insight that I think is later gained through his madness.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Any other comments or observations? Perhaps we should move on past some of the in-between scenes, though I would like to try out one moment in the play. Kent almost deliberately picks a fight with one of the servants of Albany and of Goneril. His name is Oswald. He is a lackey, a kind of a bootlicker. He has a epileptic visage. He's a kind of Smerdyakov, if you are Dostoevsky fans. He is just despicable. And so Kent picks a fight with him and deliberately provokes a fight. If you want to find a list of words to call somebody, there is nothing as magnificent as Shakespeare. He can just ream a person out without ever repeating himself. This passage I'd like to try out on you. Oswald, what dost thou know me for? Oswald is literally bugging him. And Kent says, a knave, a rascal, an eater of broken meats, a base, proud, shallow, beggarly, three-suited, 100-pound, filthy, worsted, stocking knave, a lily-livered, action-taking, whore-sun, glass-gazing, a super-serviceable, finical rogue, one trunk-inheriting slave, one that wouldst be a bawd in a way of a good service and art nothing but the composition of a knave, beggar, coward, pander, the son and heir of a mongrel bitch, one whom I would beat into a clamorous whining if thou deniedst the least syllable of thy addition. Well, it's a magnificent scene, and needless to say, Kent gets what he wants. He gets thrown into the stocks, you know, and he has to sit out there all night. Now, the effect of that, of course, is that's going to enrage the king, because that's my man, and you don't put the king's man into stocks. Yeah, Marshall? The expletives?
Yeah.
I have not seen it. I take it as seriously. I mean, we laugh because I'm, in a way, pulling it out of context, because it's such a magnificent reaming out. But anyone remember, those of you who've seen it?
Well, it's part of a plot, and so it's not that the fellow is angry, it's that he is trying to get himself into a situation, and it's deucedly clever.
Yes.
And I think the cleverness of it adds a note of humor to the whole thing, and at least the audience response, as I remember it, was that, you know, we were trying to think how many other names you could get, and you know, kind of encouraging him to keep going, you know, because it seems to be working. Whatever you want, I think you're going to get it. You know, very clever, but I think there was an element of humor in it, although it was serious business. I think I sense the humor and the cleverness.
Yeah, he is plotting to get himself thrown into stocks or into some kind of a rebuke from the current powers that be. And it, again, it in a sense, people show their colors here. Gloucester, who in whose home this is taking place, pleads that they don't do this because this is the king's son. So we sense which way Gloucester's sympathies are going to go. Now, a momentary remark about the subplot. Edgar comes on stage now, who is the son of Gloucester, who was disowned and there was a price over his head. And he comes onto the stage in flight. And that's, I think, one of the great dramatic images. At least, I think, one fairly good director whose book that I found a lot of insight in, it's called The Masks of Lear, I think his name is Rosenberg, says one of the great themes of the play is flight. And that's not so much talked about as seen. Everyone is in flight, running away. And Edgar is the great symbol of this. And what he does in order to stay around and also to save himself is he dresses himself up as a madman, which means he undresses himself. He's virtually naked, except for some clothes, probably underwear on stage, but he puts various kinds of weeds and flowers around himself, dresses himself up in. And we want to keep our eye on him because he will then later on in the play take an important role as far as we're going to see the king divested in a moment. I'd like to single out one line which the fool makes, or several of them. He is here with Lear again, and sings a little song like this: fathers that wear rags do make their children blind, but fathers that bear bags shall see their children kind. Fortune, that errant whore, ne'er turns the key to the poor. It's not a very wise thing to give all your goods away as a parent. He's singing. Lear, his heart is swelling more and more, and he's talking himself down, don't get angry, and in doing that, he gets more and more angry. And the fool says to Kent why he would be following such a fellow, and says, all that follow their noses are led by their eyes, except blind men. And there's not a nose among 20 but can smell him that's stinking. Let go thy hold when a great wheel runs down a hill, lest it break thy neck with following it. But the great one that goes upward, let him draw thee after. It's a really interesting image, the image of a wheel. The wheel that's going downhill, and he's saying, you let go of that wheel or it'll destroy you. Isn't that one of the great images of tragedy, that not just one individual is destroyed, but others too? And now the beauty of it is that Kent doesn't let go. He's going to go down with the king, and that's beautiful. That somehow assigns the king some worth anyway, though he does a lot of dumb things. And look what the fool, well, a little later the fool will say, directly upon that, the fool has another little song, or if not a song, at least a poem. And he says, that, sir, which serves and seeks for gain and follows but for form, will pack when it begins to rain and leave thee in the storm. But I will tarry, the fool will stay, and let the wise man fly. Well, now some interchange between Lear and Gloucester and those who have divested him of his servant, why he's in the stocks. The king tends to lose his temper and his rage, and rages on about why he was his man put into the stocks. And they don't even answer his question until finally he is given an answer. And at this time the king is so angry that he says, he is going to go with his sister Regan for sure now. And Regan in turn says, you should return to Goneril. And the king three times repeats the word return, to her with 50 men dismissed. The conversation goes back and forth, and within just a few lines, they strip him from 100 to 50 to 25 to 10 to 5 to 1. And Regan, what needs he won? Lear, at this point, almost snaps. O reason not the need, our basest beggars are in the poorest things superfluous. Allow not nature more than nature's needs. Man's life is cheap as a beast's. I'd like to read that whole passage. He is talking about the fact that he could then go into a noble rage, and he says, you unnatural hags, I will have such revenges on you both that all the world shall, I will do such things, what they are yet I know not. And that's a terrible moment, because the king no longer has the power to enforce what he would like to do. And he says at the end, or I will weep, O fool, ere I go mad. He tells him, he's trying to talk himself into not weeping, and then he says he will weep. And then he's taken out, and Gloucester says, the king is in high rage. This is the beginning of the great scene on the heath now, where the king finally really goes mad.
I kind of like to do the highlight when you're talking about
some of the big speeches.
Well, the one you said is coming out, so.
Well, it's a long one. I mean, it's not just one speech, but it's a whole series of scenes where he's out on the heath. And it's magnificent poetry. Shakespeare, for example, first tells us that the king is out there in the storm, and what he is doing is contending with the elements. This is scene one. He bids the wind blow the earth into the sea. Listen to that language. No. So we get an anticipation of what the king is going to be like. That things might change or cease, tears his white hair, which the impetuous blasts with eyeless rage catch in their fury and make nothing of, and so on. Now, Shakespeare really is doing some risky things, because that's great poetry. Can he live up to it? Lear, when we finally hear him, next scene. Blow, winds, and crack your cheeks. Rage, blow, you cataracts and hurricanoes. Spout till you have drenched our steeples, drowned the cocks. You sulphurous and thought-executing fires, vaunt couriers of oak-cleaving thunderbolts, singe my white head, and thou all shaking thunder, strike flat the round rotundity, thick rotundity of the world. Crack nature's moles, all germains spill at once, that make ingrateful man. Terrible language. Rumble thy bellyful, spit fire, spout rain. Nor rain, wind, thunder, fire are my daughters. I tax you not, you elements, with unkindness. I never gave you kingdom, called you children. You owe me no subscription. Then let fall your horrible pleasure. Here I stand your slave, a poor, infirm, weak, and despised old man. But yet I call you servile ministers, that you will with two pernicious daughters join your high engendered battle against a head so old and white as this. Oh, 'tis foul. Well, that's great language. Just magnificent. Where we can go on? Sure. I was going to move to Ghosts, which is a modern tragedy and lacks that whole world in which Shakespeare can lay out his tragedy like this. Ibsen tries to do something like a modern tragedy in our world, where this whole Elizabethan world picture has just collapsed. But we can postpone that. You know, there's no law of the Medes and Persians that we have to do that tomorrow. And then we could continue. We could go as far as we will go today and then go on tomorrow. Would you like to do that?
Did you really finish the Oedipus the other day also? Or did you, like, do more on both of them tomorrow?
The question, did we finish with Oedipus, you know, one never finishes with Oedipus. Not really, but I forewent the pleasure of reading it because, well, for several reasons. I felt we could do it in summary fashion, whereas to summarize Lear just doesn't do justice to the power that, that it evokes through its language. We're not going to get at the questions. Yes, there is. There is a time slot tomorrow, 4 o'clock, on the schedule. So
instead of the ghosts, you mean?
Instead of ghosts. I'll be happy to drop ghosts. I mean, I think in stature this is, you know, considerably more important. All right, let's makes a remark when he cries for the criminals. Well, maybe we ought to back up to another statement. One of the interesting questions about which critics have many different opinions is what it is, finally, that is the real flaw in Lear's whole makeup. Some people have said it's a lack of judgment. Others say it's a lack of patience. It's his impatience. Others say it's his anger. So you see, you get a number of different... some his vanity. At any rate, as he's on stage, up to now he was alone, Kent enters and Lear says, "No, I will be the pattern of all patience. I will say nothing." And two lines later, Lear goes on for another 15, 20 lines. In other words, he can't stop himself. He says, "I will say nothing," and then on he goes again. And his speech, "Let the great gods that keep this dreadful putter o'er our heads find out their enemies now." So he wants the gods to get the wicked people. And then he says, "Tremble, you wretch, and you caitiff, and you criminal," and so on. And he concludes that speech by saying, "I am a man more sinned against than sinning." So he's still saying, "You get those people who have done this to me. I'm a man more sinned against than sinning." There is an interesting counterpoint, a sensitivity. He's not saying he's altogether innocent either, right? "I'm a man more sinned against than sinning." So there are little shreds of insight. Lear, my wits begin to turn. The fool has a great chaos speech at the end of that scene. "When priests are more in word than matter, when brewers mar their malt with water, when nobles are their tailors' tutors, no heretics burned, but wenches suitors, when every case in law is right, no squire in debt, nor no poor knight, when slanderers do not live in tongues, nor cut purses come not to throngs, when usurers tell their gold in the field, and bawds and whores do churches build, then shall the realm of Albion come to great confusion." The fool's statement really catches the sense of how everything's topsy-turvy in this world. And you can see some powerful statements here which support the readings of the people who say the ultimate meaning of this play is a nihilistic one, because that's more true about life than anything else.
Does the fool belong to the king?
Yes. Well, I have the feeling he really kind of belonged to Cordelia, or at least he was Cordelia's favorite. But he is the king's fool, and he sticks with him through thick and thin. It's very touching.
Why the reference to Merlin?
The Merlin? Well, Albion, I think, is the old... I didn't read that. "This prophecy of Merlin shall make, for I live before his time." I'm not sure exactly. He says all sorts of things come so fast they're hard to grasp. But Albion is the old ancient word for England. And if this is set in the pre-Roman times, then Merlin suddenly becomes a factor here.
Merlin also lives.
Does he?
He lives from the future
into the past. And I think Merlin doesn't exist yet, because it says, "This prophecy Merlin shall make, for I live before his time." which really puts things upside down. Merlin is still ahead, and that reminds us, oh yes, we're way back in history. Lear again on the heath, interesting remark where he contrasts the tempest in the air with a tempest in himself. They want him to come inside, and he says, I'd rather stay out here. Thou'd shun a bear, if thy flight lay toward the raging sea, thou'd meet the bear in the mouth. When the mind's free, the body delicate, the tempest in my mind doth from my senses take all feeling else save what beats there. Filial ingratitude. That's the one thing he can remember, right? That his personal rights were violated. Gratitude. That's what he wants. By the way, that's different than economic. It isn't just that he wants a place. And it isn't just that he wants his knights. But it's something imponderable, immeasurable. Ingratitude. I don't know if any of you have ever experienced people who are ungrateful to you and you felt that they owed you gratitude. Right. And if you know what it is to taste that kind of rage, you can appreciate here Lear. Or in turn, if we appreciate Lear, we can see what it's like to feel that way. And then he says, oh no, this way madness lies. Don't think about your daughter. But you see, that's all he can think about. He's obsessed with it. And now there's a beautiful moment. And maybe this is where we might pause and comment a little bit. Kent says, good, my lord, enter in. And then Lear makes an interesting remark. Prithee, go in thyself. Seek thine own ease. This tempest will not give me leave to ponder on things would hurt me more, but I'll go in. And then he says to the fool, I think this is one of the most beautiful pieces of poetry in the play. In, boy, go first. You houseless poverty, nay. See, he says, no, king, you ahead of me. That's a gesture. And then the king says, nay, get thee in. I'll pray. The king pray? Is he coming to some insight here, some sense of himself? And then I'll sleep. And now these beautiful lines. Poor naked wretches, wheresoe'er you are, that bide the pelting of this pitiless storm, how shall your houseless heads and unfed sides, your looped and windowed raggedness, defend you from seasons such as these? He's talking about the poor. And this is amazing that the king for once is thinking about someone else other than himself. It's a beautiful line. Then he goes on, he says, oh, I have taken too little care of this. Take physic, pomp. You know, take an enema, king. Clean yourself out, king. Take physic, pomp. Expose thyself to feel what wretches feel, that thou mayest shake the superflux to them and show the heavens more just. Feel what the poor feel, so that you will be able to shake the superflux, all the excess that you have to them, to show the heavens more just. A moment of insight, you know, a moment of sanity, or some people are more critical, sentimentality. The king feeling sorry for himself, and therefore feeling sorry for the poor. Dreaming about being generous to all the poor. But it's past that. He'll never have the chance again. It's a rich moment and a beautiful piece of poetry, I think. At that point, Edgar is outside. And again, to me, this is touching to the point of tears. Edgar says, fathom and a half, fathom and a half, poor Tom. Why fathom and a half? Where do you say that normally? At sea, right? Well, why is he saying it? It's pouring cats and dogs, right? So he's pretending he's crazy, right? He's got to. And poor Tom of Bedlam, Bedlam was the name for the insane hospital in England, and Tom of Bedlam was just any lunatic. And so he's out there in the night. And then finally Edgar enters, and it's a shattering moment to see him come in, completely crazy, but not crazy, only pretending. And then here are some of his lines, magnificent. Away, the foul fiend follows me. Through the sharp hawthorn blows the cold wind. Go to your bed and warm thee. Lear, didst thou give all to thy daughters? And art thou come to this? If anyone is in trouble, that person must have been done in by his daughters. In fact, must have given his own goods away. See, he reads everything in terms of his obsession. Edgar, who gives anything to poor Tom, whom the foul fiend hath led through fire and through flame, through ford and whirlpool, or bog and quagmire, that hath laid knives under his pillow, and halters in his pew, set ratsbane by his porridge, made him proud of heart, to ride on a bay trotting horse over 4-inch bridges, to course o'er his own shadow for a traitor. Bless thy five wits, Tom's a cold, oh, doty, doty, doty. Bless thee from whirlwind, star blasting and taking, do poor Tom some charity, whom the foul fiend vexes. There could I have him now, and there again, and there. Script groping for the monster that is plaguing him. What, have his daughters brought him to this pass? Couldst thou save nothing? Wouldst thou give them all? Well, this gives us some feel of how Lear, in his madness, is continually expressing the agony that he can't get over. That he's made this terrible mistake, and now he's suffering for it. Okay, I think perhaps we're just about at, in a way, the nadir of part of his self-awareness. Edgar, Lear asks him who he has been, and Edgar has a great speech about what a wicked man he was, which is quite magnificently made up. And then Lear concludes with a statement where he has not just been reduced from a king to a nobody or from a great man to an old man, but what he is here now is he's been reduced virtually to, he's not even a human being anymore. Lear says to Edgar, thou wert better in a grave than to answer with thy uncovered body this extremity of the skies. Is man no more than this? Consider him well. Thou owest the worm no silk, the beast no hide, the sheep no wool, the cat no perfume. Ha! Here's three ones are sophisticated, namely Lear himself and the fool. Thou art the thing itself, unaccommodated, undressed, bare man, is no more but such a poor, bare, unforked animal as thou. Off, off, you lendlings. That's how he calls his clothing. Come, unbutton here. And at that time, he probably rips his shirt off and is himself probably bare-chested. Shakespeare does a lot with the imagery of the clothing. And when a person is bare and naked, he's reduced to nothing, particularly if his clothing were the clothes once of a king. Later in the play, when his daughter finally gets to him, one of the things that she does is she has him dressed in his kingly robes again. And that's very touching. First of all, that she is there, and then that she brings him back to his sanity. So the imagery of the clothing in the sense of clothing the naked. It's very important. And that's why this moment is so important, because he finally, when he sees Edgar, who's completely gone in his own mind, I mean, Lear perceives him as that, it brings Lear back to sanity. He can relate to this. And then he divests himself of all that he has. And I think it's at this point that they bring him in and give him some shelter. And now from here on in, I think the story begins to move along, and perhaps this is a good place to for me to stop, but I want to see if you have any questions or comments. Some of you may have copies of the play with you and are following along. I'm delighted that you're here, that you're interested. I hope that that you will, if you're here tomorrow, that you will bring your questions and comments. We'll try to conclude the play, and I think we'll be able to do that pretty nicely in the early part of the session. And then I think we want to raise some questions about what does the play say about life, and what is Shakespeare saying in this play? Because there have been some very, very different interpretations.
Is there any kind of teaching today, or, you know, I don't know why, but, you know, Lear goes insane, you know, to the daughters in gratitude and this kind of thing. And any, you know, he begins to contrast in the plight of the poor and the plight of the people who are miserable in hell. You know, maybe he should have given it to them or something like that. I don't know, it just seems to strike me in the sense that his attempt to give it away, but to give it away to those people and still have possession of it somehow or another, as opposed to just the giving of things. Yeah, I don't even know, but.
You mean, for example, is Shakespeare hinting at something here, that there ought to be something like a redistribution of wealth and so on? Shakespeare is very chary about moralizing. I think of all the playwrights that I know, he is one of the most reluctant to do that. If we want to draw conclusions from this, he permits us to do that. That is to say, we can pick all sorts of like Jack Horner's, we can put in our thumb and find a lot of plums. No. But Shakespeare, I don't think. Anyone want to observe about this? Comment about it? Is that true to your own experience with Shakespeare, that he really pulls back from moralization and moralizing?
Oh, I think it's true.
Yeah.
I think he presents life so rich that as life itself doesn't present clearly to us, he does the same thing. It's too rich. It's too rich in his plays to define it in any one way. That's the fullness of it. I think
there's a great line in Hamlet where Hamlet says to the wandering players that they should hold a mirror up to nature, and that's one way in which people have tried to praise Shakespeare, that he so magnificently holds the mirror up to nature, saying life is like this. And yet one wants to say something more than that, because a lot of modern writers hold the mirror up to nature, and they are, you know, cynical and nihilistic and whatever else. And there's something about Shakespeare, even in the midst of all of this, that there's a great compassion. There is a tremendous love for human beings.
I wonder, you know, how do you just hold the mirror up?
Yes.
Having something behind you.
Yeah. There's a deep valuing of life you feel here, don't you? Which may, in a part, tip our hand as to what we say about the total interpretation of the play vis-a-vis the nihilistic interpretation, but that's okay, too. Okay, well, this has been an interesting afternoon. Thank you for your presence, and I hope to see many of you tomorrow.